Hello and welcome behind the news. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And coming back after a fundraising break, and thanks to all of you who contributed to make this a very successful fund drive. And if you made a pledge, please don't forget to send it in. We've got two segments up. First, in a few minutes, we'll talk to Tariq Ali, a frequent guest on this program, about what we're now calling AFPAC, as if they're just one place, Afghanistan and Pakistan. Afghanistan going through some strange election rituals right now. And Pakistan, I learned reading the New York Times this morning, hates us, or at least 25% of the population hates us. So we'll ask Tariq, who is a native of Pakistan, whether that's true and what it all means. And then towards the bottom of the hour, we will be joined in the studio by Astra Taylor, who is the director of a very fine new documentary called Examined Life, a conversation, set of conversations with nine contemporary philosophers, which is also being accompanied by a book, which is a transcript of those conversations, actually the full conversations, not just the excerpts you see in the documentary, also called Examined Life, that just out from the New Press. We'll talk to Astra about philosophy and how you make a movie about philosophers. Before all that, some brief words on the economic news, and in those, that economic news, more of the same, stumbling in the real-world indicators of the present, upward movement in the leading indicators of the future. On Tuesday, we learned that housing starts, that is groundbreaking on new residential units, fell by 1% in July, a contrast with the sharp increases in the two previous months. But the headline number was dragged down by weakness in multi-unit dwellings, apartment houses, that is. Single-family starts were up by 2%. The overall pattern, though, is one of bouncing around the bottom without really taking off. On Thursday morning, we learned that first-time claims for unemployment insurance rose by 15,000 last week, and the number of those continuing to draw benefits was also up a hair. While initial claims are down 100,000 from their peak last April, the improving trend now looks to have stalled. So again, more bouncing around the bottom without any real taking off. But also on Thursday, the Conference Board reported that its index of leading indicators, which forecast changes in the broad economy 3 to 6 months out, rose for the fourth consecutive month in July. The so-called coincident index, which is a composite designed to summarize the current state of the economy, was unchanged for the month. This suggests that the recession is drawing to a close, and we can expect the first signs of recovery in the fall. Let's hope so, but it's not yet visible in the numbers. As you may have heard, the Obama administration and some people in Congress have been talking about raising money to finance health care reform by taxing employee health benefits, which are currently free from tax. When John McCain advocated this during last year's presidential campaign, Democrats, including candidate Obama, howled with outrage at the inequity of it all. But now that changiness is the established order in Washington, opinions have also changed. Of course, since Democrats sometimes have to look like the party of the people instead of the party of capital that they are, they make equity arguments in favor of a policy they once found noxious. That is, as they sometimes put it, it's not fair that the gold-plated health benefits enjoyed by top execs aren't taxed, since they are ultimately a form of income, high income at that. Well, it might not surprise you to learn that these equity arguments have little basis in fact. The invaluable duo of David Himmelstein and Steffi Woolhandler, the two primary care physicians in Massachusetts, who tirelessly analyze the insanity that is our present healthcare finance system and who equally tirelessly agitate for a single-payer scheme, have an article that's just out in the New England Journal of Medicine that takes a close look at who the taxation of benefits would hit and how hard. As it turns out, the poorer you are, the harder you'd be hit. Of course, far fewer low-paid workers have health insurance than well-paid ones. Just 11% of families with incomes under $10,000 are covered. The share rises steadily with income. 42% of those with incomes between $40,000 and $50,000, and 62% of those with incomes above $100,000 enjoy health insurance paid for by the employers. Actually, though, it's a little shocking that more than a third of the 100,000-plus households don't have employer-paid health insurance. But for families that do have coverage, the poorer you are, the bigger the benefit as a share of your income. For example, taxing health benefits would cost insured families with incomes under $10,000 over 18% of their income. It would cost those with incomes in the $40,000 to $50,000 range about 8% of their income, but it only hit the 100,000-plus set with a less than 3% bite. And the further up you go, the gentler the bite. Quoting Himmelstein and Woolhandler's conclusion, a Goldman Sachs exec who enjoyed the firm's infamous $40,000 health plan got a federal tax subsidy of about $15,000 last year. but that's only 0.1% of the bonuses received by the company's four top earners. So their taxing health benefits would spare the uninsured. The average poor family with employer-paid coverage would be taxed at a rate 140 times higher than Wall Street titans. In our book, that's a regressive tax. In my book, too. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk AFPAC with Tariq Ali.
Taking nothing but his daddy's old phone, recognized he traded but a little for the wayward life. A faint heart never won their hand, the soul says the road to England. From a high on a hill came the clarion call to gain young men. Come on, one, come on. Make muster against the foreign. She did weep and wail, saying, Lord, have mercy, where did I fail? Out my belly, they pick up her gun, and all for the road to England.
And that some of Nick Lowe's song, which I suspect is about the Falklands or Malvinas War, depending upon your point of view, the Rose of England. And we're now joined on the line by Tariq Ali, who graciously stayed up after 10 o'clock and is remarkably coherent even at that late hour. I envy his facility with words. Welcome, Tariq.
Hi there, Doug.
So I learned in this morning's New York Times that 25% of Pakistanis hate Americans. Is this true?
I would say that that's a sort of low figure. The last opinion poll showed that 75% of the country was totally against the U.S. presence in the region. Hating, of course, American individuals, that's different. But still, it's a low figure, in my opinion. And this anger in Pakistan has increased since Obama came. Curiously enough, because he's escalated the war inside Pakistan itself.
Yeah, I want to come back to Pakistan in a bit, but let's talk about Afghanistan now. There's an election underway. Is this a credible election that's happening?
No, of course not. I mean, no one takes it seriously. No intelligence organization in the West takes it seriously. The fact that they'll put on a big act and say, the very fact that we've had an election is a big victory, just shows how desperate they are, because, you have 200,000 troops there guarding the ballot boxes. You have a corrupt president who's been doing deals with warlords and drug barons and totally crazed Shia Islamic fundamentalists, some of them accused of war crimes. And so he'll probably get whatever it's been agreed he will get, whether it's 40% or 45%. The only two serious opponents were former members of his cabinet.
How's it going to happen? Is it they cooking the ballot box? Are they going to count it funny? Or is it just that's what's going to happen?
Well, I think the turnout is very low, okay, in that country. I mean, no one takes these things too seriously. So they'll probably be putting ballots in and claiming it was a reasonable turnout. I mean, that's what usually happens. And since there's no one to check, nobody cares. And the fact is that the election will have nil impact on the country as a whole. People see it as the farce it is. Because how can you have a free election in a country which is occupied by foreign troops? I mean, it's like saying that if in wartime, Second World Wartime, France occupied by German troops, you could have had a free election.
You said Karzai is a corrupt figure. I think a lot of Americans don't realize that. So could you flesh that out, Sean?
Well, I think even the New York Times about a year ago now published a detailed report saying that corruption in Afghanistan is rife. Hamid Karzai's brother, Wali Karzai, is the country's richest man. This is something new. It sort of postdates the occupation of that country. And he's grown rich through drugs and arms smuggling. Under Karzai, Afghanistan now has become a total narco state, and his cronies are, you know, rolling in it, making money, building large houses, stealing land. It's well known. And so you have a surreal situation where this is what the government's doing. Then you have large numbers of foreigners there, either NGOs or mercenaries and foreign troops who live in their own bubble world. And the rest of the country just watches in amazement. It's hardly surprising that so many of the Pashtuns, who are a majority in Afghanistan, have now joined the other side and are fighting back. I mean, that's essentially what's going on. And the election isn't going to convince anyone. Doug, they had an election in Iraq some time ago, and we were told that was now calmed down, and what a big triumph. And then today we've seen massive explosions taking place in Baghdad itself. So these things are essentially for show. They have an ideological and propaganda value. Look, aren't we great? This is democracy. But what I refer to this process is it's not democracy, but democratism. That is to show the people back home, look, we've done good in that country. It means absolutely nothing.
Now, you started to talk about Karzai's two opponents. Who are they?
Karzai's opponents are two former members of his own cabinet, who were basically saying to the United States, you've tried this guy out, really, he hasn't been able to do the business for you. Why not dump him and give us a chance? And there was a time when the U.S. was thinking of dumping him, but I think they can't find anyone else. And the last candidate was, I've forgotten his name now, he's a totally irrelevant figure, but he was essentially... Yeah, his name is Ramzan Bashir Dost. He's a former World Bank official. And even he said today that this is not an election, this is a comedy. Now, you know, no one could accuse him of being hostile to U.S. interests or global capitalism. But anyone who's sort of even halfway serious and objective will tell you that.
Actually, I think one of the candidates was on this show once years ago, Ashraf Ghani, when he was anthropology professor at University of Texas, is that right?
Yeah.
And then he went on. So these are all people with imprimaturs of having run through American institutions, which I guess qualifies as the presidents of Afghanistan.
Yeah. And they're the candidates, and most of them are sort of squealing in pain and anger because the Karzai hasn't given them a look in. He's determined to run the country his way. And the fact that the U.S. can't find a replacement for him is indicative of the crisis they're in, which is why Washington has been making overtures to the neo-Taliban, leading the resistance, and offering them places in a coalition government. You know, this has been going on for 2 years now. And those guys are saying, we're prepared to be part of a coalition government, but not while foreign troops are in our country. And of course, once foreign troops leave, they'll have to take Karzai with them.
And regardless of personnel, does the government of Afghanistan have any resources or power?
No, nil. And, you know, this notion of the Pashtuns who are fighting back being hiding in mountains, it's just total nonsense, actually, Doug. You know, my colleague Patrick Coburn, who's been there recently, says that the minute the sun sets, the Taliban control all the main arteries into Kabul. You can't get into Kabul unless they let you come. They're taxing trade. They're basically running large swathes of the country and only taking on the United States when they feel they can. Classic guerrilla operation, guerrilla warfare. I mean, one of the Pashtun leaders interviewed in The Guardian 2 days ago was asked, what do you think of the U.S. sending more troops in? He said, it's really great for us because now we have more targets.
And it used to be said that Karzai was the mayor of Kabul. It sounds like he's not even controlling the suburbs.
He's not even the mayor of Kabul now. He's the sort of housekeeper of his own palace and guarded by, you know, private troops from U.S. corporations. Blackwater used to guard him. Whether they still do or not, I don't know. But he refuses to trust any Afghans to guard him. And I can't say I blame him on that, actually, because he's totally hated now.
Now, what do you make of the Obama administration now redoubling its efforts in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, I heard quite a bit of your program, Doug, while I was waiting. And the disaster of their health reforms, and the disaster is not just that the Republicans are doing this to them, it's the Democrats in Congress and the Senate who they can't completely get under control. Such is the power of corporate lobbies, so they're caving in. And the same abroad. I mean, first, if we just mention Iraq briefly, the notion that they're going to pull out is just nonsense. What they're planning to do is build large U.S. residential bases and military bases there and keep the troops in like the British did in the 1940s and 50s. They moved out of the towns and built themselves bases, and then they were chucked out when there was a big upheaval in 1958. And this is exactly now what the United States is planning to do, and it will be a continuing factor for destabilizing the region. So Iraq is not sorted at all. Then you have an escalation in Afghanistan where Barack Obama thought that sending more troops in would sort the problem out. Lots of people told him it wouldn't, including the former head of CIA station in Kabul, who wrote a very good piece in the Huffington Post saying it's not going to work, Barack, and basically carrying on with Bush's policies and not seeing what's going on the ground in Afghanistan is an indication that you haven't woken up and do realize we're part of the problem, not the solution. Now, these are the words the CIA head of station in Kabul, till recently, senior CIA figure. And, you know, in private, people are far more vocal. So there's no doubt that Washington and the White House knows exactly what is going on, and they're too scared to come up with some exit strategy. I mean, killing more people isn't going to do the trick. Someone asked me the other day, do you think they could stabilize Afghanistan? I said, well, they'd have to kill 2 or 3 million people. And Afghanistan's only got a population of 24, 25 million. They'd have to kill largely 2 to 3 million Pashtuns, send in more troops, so there are 500,000 American troops there. And if you think that will settle it permanently, I say it's complete nonsense. It will then spread into Pakistan, where the Pashtuns will be completely fired up, and the U.S. will have an entire region in flames.
It's amazing. It makes you wonder about American military power, that the U.S., despite all its resources and high-tech weaponry, can't subdue these two rather small countries.
They can't do it because the population is up in arms, essentially. That is a fact. Now, the argument given by reactionary conservatives, usually Brits, historians, Neil Ferguson, J.M. Roberts, says, do it like the British did. Well, we know the cock-ups the British got into. You know, I mean, the notion that the British Empire was a huge success, which is what these people are arguing, is just nonsense. Had it been, it wouldn't have been forced to leave ignominiously from most of its important colonies like India and Iraq in the late 50s. So there is no way out if your plan is to embark on a new colonialism, which is what the U.S. seems to have done in Iraq and Afghanistan. They have no way out if they do that. I mean, the only way out is some regional solution, but the longer they leave it, the more it looks as if they won't be able to do that either. And if they can't do that and have to leave in a humiliated way, they'll be humiliated. Then what you'll see essentially is a new national Pashtun government in Kabul, what it calls itself, Taliban, neo-Taliban, I don't know, doesn't make much difference, which will then do a deal with Pakistani military intelligence and we'll be back to square one.
And I was speaking with Tariq Ali, the London-based writer on politics and also filmmaker and novelist as well. So what is your best idea of what the Obama administration hopes to accomplish in Afghanistan? Are they merely doing this for domestic consumption so they don't get called pussies by the Republicans, or is there some kind of strategic goal behind this?
Well, look, that is what it seemed during the election campaign, that some of Obama's apologists said he can't pull out of two countries. Well, at the moment, he's pulling out of neither. So I think there is heavy pressure on him from the, you know, Democrats and the Republicans, and they say if we pull out, you know, we might lose the next election. The domestic pressure is that this is a government which is an administration which is constantly thinking about the next 4 years. I mean, they haven't got off to a great start in these 4 years, but they're already thinking of the next 4 years. So that colors how they operate. Don't offend anyone, try and unite people, even people who don't agree with us, et cetera, domestically. And abroad, do what has to be done without losing too many American bodies. I think that is what it's doing. And beyond that, it doesn't have, you know, a very serious plan for either Afghanistan or Pakistan. I mean, you know, Richard Holbrooke can spend all the time he likes in a Karachi slum talking to the poor. And what people say to him, I don't know. But the minute he goes, people will be laughing behind his back. I mean, it's... The U.S. has been running that country for such a long time now. And Patterson, the ambassador, more or less behaves like the old British viceroys used to do, meets politicians, greets them, interferes in national politics. And given where she was ambassador before she came to Pakistan, I think she's used to doing it because she was in Colombia before that.
All right, let's talk some about Pakistan. First of all, how active is Pakistani intelligence in supporting the Taliban?
Well, Pakistani intelligence, military intelligence, one thing we should just get clear, it is not a rogue outfit any more than the Defense Intelligence Agency in Washington is a rogue outfit. The Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence, the ISI, is totally controlled by the military top brass. The current head of the army, General Kiani, his last job was head of the ISI. During Musharraf's rule, they cleared it out of a lot of, you know, ultra-fundamentalist officers, and it's now completely under their control. And it sometimes suits all sides to blame things on the ISI, and everyone laughs because people know in Pakistan that they couldn't do it without the agreement of the army. They obey orders. They are military personnel. Now, the Pakistani military obviously sees Afghanistan as its sphere of influence. The only victory they ever won was when they put the Taliban in power with the agreement of the United States. Now, they are just waiting for the crisis to get worse, and they will then resume negotiations and talks, and they will hope that their influence in that region will be restored. And the U.S. might be in such a desperate situation by that time that they might have no other alternative but to ask the Pakistani army to carry on. So given all this, it would be crazy from the position of the Pakistani army to completely alienate all the Taliban groups in the country, and they negotiate with some, they fight with others, but they're in touch with them most of the time.
And we're in the habit of referring to the Taliban as sort of a singular organization, but as you just alluded to, it is a complicated bunch of different interest groups, isn't it?
It's many, many different groups now, Doug. And, you know, in the West, it always suits the West, especially these days in the sort of simplistic media lingo that is used to just one name, Al-Qaeda. First, Al-Qaeda was everywhere. Now they've sort of dropped that for a bit. Now it's the Taliban. Sometimes they mix the two up. They have no idea what's going on there. And essentially, there are dozens of groups, some small, some large, which are all fighting under the Taliban umbrella in Afghanistan and targeting the NATO armies. The Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, the Pakistan-Taliban movement, is led by tribal leaders. And they have their own gripe with the Pakistani military, which they feel has betrayed them, having armed them, having helped them. Now they're turning on them to get money from the United States. This is how they see it. On the other hand, the Afghan groups fighting the NATO armies are very angry with the Pakistani Taliban, saying that your target should not be the Pakistan army, but the NATO forces. What the hell are you doing this for? So it's a murky situation in that part of the world, and just referring to everyone as Taliban doesn't help anything.
And What about Pakistan itself? What is the U.S., the increasing U.S. presence nearby and increasing talk of targeting Pakistan itself? What's this doing in Pakistan?
Well, I mean, just look at the following symbolism, Doug. That the same day that the tragedy happened in Tehran when that young woman was killed, who wasn't even demonstrating, by the police, and Obama stood with, you know, tears in his eyes, sort of saying what a tragedy it was. That same day, in Pakistan, a U.S. drone killed 60 people, mainly women and children. So people, you know, form their own judgments that there's double standards, that there's Western hypocrisy, that when it suits them, they shed tears. When it suits them, they kill and behave even more brutally than the people in Iran. So this creates a great deal of bitterness and anger. Now, while it is true that a lot of people in Pakistan are very fed up with their local variant of the Taliban for what they've been doing, and it's very interesting that there were angry demonstrations when the videos of the small Taliban group in Pakistan flogging a woman were shown. There were demonstrations, and the Taliban then were forced publicly to deny it. They were lying through their teeth, of course, but they said it wasn't us who did it. This is not our position. And political pressure is the way to reduce their influence even further. At the same time, a large majority in the country believes that the reason this mess is there and getting worse is the Western presence. So it's a double-edged sword, what's going on in that country. And at the same time, you have a civilian government which does whatever the U.S. asks it to do. They don't care. They'll do all that as long as they can carry on making money, getting big cuts on business deals, etc. And I recently wrote an article in the London Review of Books, and I quoted a senior intelligence official from the European Union who told me that when he was in Islamabad talking to Ann Patterson, the U.S. ambassador, she said, "We prefer Zardari to Musharraf." "Why?" he asked, assuming she'd say because he's a Democrat. She said, "Oh, because Musharraf often used to go to Washington, say one thing to us and come back and do something different, whereas Zardari does everything we tell him to." Now, the European intelligence official was a bit shocked at the cynicism. I said, you know, the problem is not her candor. The problem is bad judgment. Because if they think that Zardari is going to help them stabilize Pakistan, they've got another thing coming. The guy is absolutely despised and hated. I mean, he is a Pakistani Karzai.
Well, it sounds like one big mess. And
it is a big mess.
We're out of time, so we can't have you explain how to solve all this sometime in the future.
Very good. Okay.
All right, thank you for joining us, Tariq. I've been speaking with Tariq Ali, the London-based writer, analyst of politics, playwright, filmmaker, all-around man of letters. And let's take a station break, and we'll be back to talk about The Examined Life.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial. New York.
Pencil.
Okay, this is Joe Franklin broadcasting on radio station WBAI.
It's 99.5% all natural and preservative free. WBAI FM in New York.
I love this radio station.
And this is WBAI, not only in New York at 99.5 in your FM dial, but also on the web around the world at WBAI.org. And if you miss a chance to pledge during our recent fund drive, well, you can do that on the website by hitting the donate button. Please do that early and often. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Astra Taylor.
I'm not afraid to
And that's some of a song called Get Up, Feel It by a duo called Balls to the Wall, Brooklyn-based pair of women and their electronic machines. We're now joined in the studio by Astra Taylor, who is a filmmaker and writer, and she did a movie a few years ago called Zizek, a splendid profile of the philosopher Slavoj Zizek, and now she's just out with a new documentary. Well, it's been out a few months, but it's still pretty new, called Examined Life, and there's also the New Press has just published a book of interviews, the full interviews from which that movie was drawn, also called Examined Life. Our conversations with contemporary thinkers, and welcome to Behind the News, Astra.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
So it's 9 philosophers. Do I have my count right?
Well, 9 philosophers, 8 professional philosophers, and actually Judith Butler takes a walk with my sister, Sonora Taylor. So she is counted in the cast, but she's actually a painter. She's 25 years old. She just got her MFA from Berkeley. So
we'll be hearing some of that about 20 minutes or so. But before we do that, tell us about this project. How did you get the idea? I mean, philosophy is not something that one thinks of in relation to the movie screen. So how did you get this idea?
It's absolutely not something people associate with cinema. And in fact, when I was first pitching this idea, I encountered closed door after closed door, and people's eyes would sort of glaze over and ask me what I thought I was thinking. But I've always gotten a sort of almost irrational enjoyment from reading philosophy. And I think that philosophy and film are uniquely simpatico in that they are both engaged in shifting perception. And sometimes I'll get the same feeling from a good documentary as I will from a new theory, that I see the world in a way that I've never conceptualized it before. There's sort of light shed on something that's always been in the shadows. So it also just seemed like an interesting challenge. And the fact that people were so skeptical of the fact these two disciplines could be married made me more motivated to try it.
All right, I want to play just a 7-second excerpt. Cornel West in the back of a New York City taxi cab making this pronouncement, which you can take as seriously or as humorously as you like, but I just love this passage.
See, I'm a blues man in the life of the mind. I'm a jazz man in a world of ideas. Therefore, for me, music is central.
All right, that's just a little flavor of Cornel West, who appears throughout the film, not just in one segment. Sort of, he's a recurring figure, and well, if you like that sort of thing, you'll be very entertained. Now, it's all structured around walking, too, right? People walking around and talking. There is a philosophical angle to the walk.
Oh, the walk serves many purposes. And in fact, I got development funding just on the basis of the idea of a sort of ensemble piece about philosophy. And in the back of my mind, I thought, this is terrible. This is dreadful. I'm going to really create something dead and static. You know, where am I going to, what am I going to shoot? Philosophers in front of their bookshelves, you know? That would only serve to reinforce the common image of philosophy as something, you know, isolated, tucked away in the ivory tower, you know, hidden from the light of day. But fortunately, I'd read Rebecca Solnit's book, Wanderlust, A History of Walking. And she does a lot of things in that book. One thing she does is revisit the sort of history of walking's relationship to philosophy. So we've got, of course, the figure of Socrates, who famously roamed around the Agora and caused trouble and, you know, eventually really alarmed the authorities. We've got Aristotle's peripatetic philosophies, you know, Walter Benjamin's urban flaneur going around Paris. We've got Nietzsche, who said that a sedentary life is a sin against the Holy Spirit. Only thoughts that come from walking have any value. Kierkegaard, who was very, you know, sad that he couldn't get the girl of his dreams, so he had to take these sort of sad rambles. Hegel, I mean, the list goes on and on. So walking and philosophy really go together. And the reason is that, you know, walking sort of unites the mind-body, which is a famous dichotomy, of course, that philosophers have obsessed over. But, you know, when you walk, you get the blood flowing. You're also out intervening in public space, which is something I wanted to show. I wanted to show that philosophy can do that. It doesn't always, but it has that capacity. So the walking was a sort of symbolic way for me to illustrate this idea of getting philosophy into the streets and showing its connection to everyday life and showing that, in fact, ideas are always already around us, that they're not something that they're not separate from the sphere of everyday life. And, you know, also important to me as a filmmaker was the fact that cinema is moving images, so movies must move. And a lot of documentaries are insulted. You know, it's an insult to say, oh, that film is just talking heads. But you know, and what that means is, well, it's just static shots of people talking. It could be radio. And radio is a great medium, but it's its own thing. So
you don't need to watch somebody say they're moving their lips, do you?
No, you don't. In fact, sometimes you get more out of it by just listening. And it leaves some space for the imagination. So the walking enabled me to create almost like little short films, you know, and put them in an environment that would then, there would be this interplay between the thinker, the thought, and the space. And that hopefully that would provoke something new, something that hadn't been seen before. And also it would create a space for accidents. Because if I put these people on a soundstage and, the audio was perfect and the lighting was perfect and, you know, what can really happen? It was so much more interesting to get them out into the nitty-gritty reality, to get them out into New York where we were chased around by gutter punks or where we maybe tripped up, fell over, or where, you know, maybe a passerby would pose a question. I wanted accidents to happen.
Yeah, I was wondering, much of it was filmed in public spaces, yeah. Central Park, a garbage dump in London. We'll talk about that in a moment. But Michael Hart was rowing on the lake in Central Park, mm-hmm. and people just, was it Avital Renel was in Tompkins Square. What did people say? Were people watching you? People staring at you, wondering what you're up to?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a humorous and irreverent spirit to Examine Life, and you said you could take that quote as you will. I mean, philosophy is kind of cosmically and comically complex, and so I wanted to, call philosophy down from the heavens, which is how Cicero sort of describes Socrates, and bring it down to earth and kind of, see it interacting in common space with the common man. And people's reactions were pretty diverse. Again, Avital and I in Tompkins Square Park encountered some punk teenagers who decided to chase us about and, throw beer bottles at us and heckle the camera. A very curious security guard working for Bank of America, I believe, sort of quizzed Peter Singer on how he was going to get the rich people to give away their money to various social causes. So there were these sort of unexpected interventions, which just also sort of made us sort of wake up and we had to sort of think on our feet a bit more because of those.
I'm speaking with Astra Taylor, who is a writer and film director, and she's got a fairly new documentary called Examine Life, and along with it, a book of transcripts of interviews with 8 or 9 philosophers, depending on how you want to count it, also called Examine Life, just out from the New Press. And let's listen to an excerpt of your session with Slavoj Žižek, filmed in a garbage dump in London. And that was your inspiration, was the garbage dump?
Yeah.
It's truly splendid. And you're going to hear a lot of some machinery working in the background. And if you can see the visuals, there's like big piles of stinky stuff all over the place with a mist spray trying to cover up the odor, but not very effectively. All right, about 5 minutes of Slavoj talking with Astra in the garbage dump in London.
This is where we should start feeling at home. Part of our daily perception of reality is that this disappears from our world. When you go to the toilet, disappears. You flush it, of course, rationally, it's there in canalization and so on. But at a certain level of your most elementary experience, it disappears from your world. But the problem is that trash doesn't disappear. I think ecology, the way we approach ecological problematic, is maybe the crucial field of ideology today. And I use ideology in the traditional sense of illusory, wrong way of thinking and perceiving reality. Why? Ideology is not simply dreaming about false ideals and so on. Ideology addresses very real problems, but it mystifies them. It's really the implicit premise of ecology that the existing world is the best possible world, in the sense of it's a balanced world which is disturbed through human hubris. So why do I find this problematic? Because I think that this notion of nature as harmonious, organic, balanced, reproducing, almost living organism, which is then disturbed, perturbed, derailed through human hubris, technological exploitation, and so on, is, I think, a secular version of the religious story of the fall. And the answer should be not that there is no fall, that we are part of nature, but on the contrary, that there is no nature. Nature is not a balanced totality which then we humans disturb. Nature is a big series of unimaginable catastrophes. Ecology will slowly turn maybe into a new opium of the masses, the way, as we all know, Marx defined religion. What we expect from religion is a kind of an unquestionable highest authority. It's God's work, so it is, you don't debate it. Today, I claim ecology is more and more taking over this role of a conservative ideology. Whenever there is a new scientific breakthrough, biogenetic development, whatever, it is as if the voice which warns us not to trespass, violate a certain invisible limit, like don't do that, it would be too much. That voice is today more and more the voice of ecology, like don't mess with DNA, don't mess with nature, don't do it. This basic conservative, partly ideological mistrust of change. This is today's ecology. Another myth which is popular about ecology, namely spontaneous ideological myth, is the idea that we, Western people, in our artificial technological environment, are alienated from immediate natural environs. That we should not forget that we humans are part of the living earth. We should not forget that we are not abstract engineers, theorists who just exploit nature, that we are part of nature, that nature is our unfathomable, impenetrable background. I think that precisely is the greatest danger. Why? Think about a certain obvious paradox. We all know in what danger we all are. Global warming, possibility of other ecological catastrophes, and so on and so on. But why don't we do anything about it? It is, I think, a nice example of what in psychoanalysis we call disavowal. The logic is that of, I know very well, but I act as if I don't know. For example, precisely, in the case of ecology, I know very well there may be global warming, everything will explode, be destroyed, but after reading a treatise on it, what do? I step out, I see nice trees, birds singing, and so on. And even if I know rationally this all is in danger, I simply do not believe that this can be destroyed. So I think that what we should do to confront properly the threat of ecological catastrophe is not all this new age stuff to break out of this technological manipulative mold and to found our roots in nature, but on the contrary, to cut off even more these roots in nature. We need more alienation from our life world, from our, as it were, spontaneous nature. We should become more artificial.
And that was the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek talking about how we need to become more alienated and more artificial as a response to the ecological crisis, and not get all crunchy and new-agey and try to dissolve the alienation, but embrace it. The documentary movie Examined Life, directed by Astra Taylor, who is sitting here in the studio with us. So you just, as we were listening to that, you say people are not outraged by Slavoj's urging us to become more alienated, huh?
No, I've taken this film on the road since September. I've been on the road with it since it premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival, and I've shown it to thousands of people, and I sort of expected that maybe there would be a few that could come to fisticuffs or something. But people have generally been very intrigued, and Slavoj's statements actually resonate with the rest of the film. I mean, I'm narcissistically more interested in sort of the film as a whole as opposed to the individual thinkers. And the theme of trash comes up again and again, actually, in terms of, people speaking about sort of populations that have been outcast. sort of theorizing that which has been cast aside. So it ties in to the rest of the film in an interesting way. And the flip side of that is that there are other scenes in which people call into question this romantic idea of nature, whether it's a natural social order or, you know, a sort of anarchist view that we can just sort of remove social constraints and there will be a utopia. So Slavoj's, you know, his insights have a lot of resonance, I think, with the other subjects.
And I should say that if people couldn't always follow what he was saying in his thick Slovenian accent, you can pick up the book, Examined Life, from the New Press. And the full transcripts are there. These are the transcripts of the entire interviews you did, not with just what was edited down into the film.
Yes, well, for the film, I sort of conducted these marathon conversations, so shot over 1 or 2 days, so between 4 hours and 8 hours. Often I'd be walking backwards. I had a whole film crew. So there's a lot of material that was left on the cutting room floor because I only had 88 minutes and sort of had to get to the heart of things. So I hope that the book provides more context and sort of shows where these various thinkers are coming from, and also that it highlights the points of disagreement because, you know, it's a bunch. And they don't always see eye to eye.
I notice in the Peter Singer section, you do talk to him about his position on disabled people, and it doesn't appear in the film?
No, it's just there was so much that I couldn't get to, but obviously disability is a big part of the movie in the conversation between Judith Butler and Sonora Taylor.
Which is a nice lead into the next excerpt. Tell, in about 30 seconds, introduce your sister, Sunny, for us.
Sunny is a painter, as I said before, and an activist for disability rights. She was actually, she's in a wheelchair. She uses a wheelchair because of a congenital disability that was caused by contamination of the water supply outside of Tucson, Arizona, by what was then the Hughes Aircraft, which is now Raytheon. So, sort of military industrial pollution, and she's since, you know, become a very sort of outspoken and thoughtful disability theorist.
And here she is talking with the famous gender theorist and discursive theorist, Judith Butler. So let's listen to some of that.
I think gender and disability converge in a whole lot of different ways.
Yeah.
But one thing I think both movements do is get us to rethink what the body can do. There's an essay by the philosopher Gilles Deleuze called What Can a Body Do? And the question is supposed to challenge the traditional ways in which we think about bodies, right? Mm-hmm. We usually ask, you know, what is a body, or what is the ideal form of a body, or, you know, what's the difference between the body and the soul, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But what can a body do is a different question. It isolates a set of capacities and a set of instrumentalities or actions, and we are kind of assemblages of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I like this idea. It's not like there's an essence, and it's not like there's an ideal morphology. You know, what a body should look like. It's exactly not that question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or what a body should move like.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I found in thinking about gender and even violence against sexual minorities or gender minorities, people whose gender presentation doesn't conform with standard ideals of femininity or masculinity, is that very often it comes down to you know, how people walk, how they use their hips, what they do with their body parts, what they use their mouth for, what they use their anus for, or what they allow their anus to be used for. There's a guy in Maine who, I guess he was around 18 years old, and he walked with a very distinct swish, you know, hips going one way or another, and very feminine walk. But one day, he was walking to school, and he was attacked by three of his classmates, and he was thrown over a bridge, and he was killed. And the question that community had to deal with, and indeed the entire media that covered this event, was, you know, how could it be that somebody's gait, that somebody's style of walking could engender the desire to kill that person? And that, you know, that makes me think about the walk in a different way. I mean, a walk could be a dangerous thing.
I'm just remembering when I was little, when I did walk, I would be told that I walked like a monkey.
Oh.
And I think that for a lot of you know, disabled people, the violence and the hatred exists a lot in this reminding of people that our bodies are going to age and are going to die. And, you know, in some ways I wonder also just thinking about the monkey comment, if it is also a level of where our boundaries lie as a human and what becomes non-human.
It makes me wonder whether the person was anti-evolutionary. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe they were creationists.
Yeah, I don't...
It's like, well, why shouldn't we have some resemblance to the monkey? I mean...
Well, the monkey's actually always been my favorite animal, too. They actually played a lot of the time I was flattered.
Exactly.
Yeah. But when in those in-between moments of, you know, in between male and female, or in between death and health, when do you still count as a human?
My sense is that what's at stake here is really rethinking the human as a site of interdependency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, when you walk into the coffee shop, right, if I can go back to that moment for a moment, and you ask for the coffee, or you indeed even ask for some assistance with the coffee, you're basically posing the question, do we or do we not live in a world in which we assist each other?
Yeah.
Do we or do we not help each other with basic needs? And are basic needs there to be decided on as a social issue and not just my personal individual issue or your personal individual issue? So, I mean, there's a challenge to individualism that happens at the moment in which you ask for some assistance with the coffee cup.
Yeah, yeah.
And hopefully people will take it up and say, yes, I too live in that world in which I understand that we need each other in order to address our basic needs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I want to organize a social and political world on the basis of that recognition.
And that an excerpt from a conversation between Sonny Taylor and Judith Butler. Sonny is an artist and a disability rights activist, and Judith Butler, professor at University of California, Berkeley, and a famed gender and discourse theorist, and that from the documentary film Examined Life, directed by Astra Taylor, who is in the studio here with us for a few more minutes. And who did the music? I noticed that's prominent throughout.
Well, there are two songs that I licensed from Moondog, who you may... You may know the name. He was a blind street musician. He dressed as a Viking, and he played on Fifth Avenue at 57th Street. And he was a real sort of philosopher. There's a great track called Moondog Monologue where he does a seemingly spontaneous 5-minute riff on his sort of view of the universe. So I thought he was an appropriate sort of spirit to try to tap into. And then Heather McIntosh, who is part of the Elephant Six Collective and was recently on tour actually with Lil Wayne and Gnarls Barkley playing bass for them. She has a band called The Instruments, and so she did the rest of the composition.
And we're just about out of time, but this film has been out in the festival circuit, and now you're about to embark on taking it around the country to college campuses. So anyone who wants to find out how to do that, how do they do that?
Well, they can contact the distributor, which is Zeitgeist Films, so just zeitgeistfilms.com.
And does the film have a website, too?
Yeah, and the film doesn't have its own website, actually, but there's all the necessary information on the distributor site.
And the book, too, The Examined Life, a collection of the transcripts, full interviews that are not fully represented in the film, that just out also from the New Press. And... any plans for DVD?
DVD will be released in February, and there will be some extras as well, a couple walks that didn't make it into the final film, and some Q&As from the theatrical premiere.
And I got to say, it's just a wonderful film. It's thoughtful, entertaining, and a lot of fun to look at. And congratulations, and you do some really fine work, Astra.
Well, thanks for having me, Doug.
I've been speaking with Astra Taylor, who is the director of the film Examined Life, and also editor or author of a collection of interviews that are the basis of the film, just out from the New Press, also called Examine Life. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this, a version of a strange song by, forgetting their I'm forgetting their name, the preppy band from Colombia, but this is called Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa.
Hey, Doug, the band you're thinking of is Vampire Weekend.
And this is a remix by Esau Mwai Mwai, and a word I cannot say on the radio. Radio something. Okay, till next week. Bye. We